It's a great pleasure to be here. You make me sound almost important, but I don't believe any of it. You shouldn't either. I'm delighted to be here. I got bought a DNA test by my children a while ago and discovered that I was 30% Celtic. So I think my mother was born in Liverpool, was almost certainly Irish. So there's something about Dublin that speaks to me, and I feel I must be at least amongst cousins. It's not easy to know how to approach what we're going to do. We're trying to help ourselves remember effectively the importance of Catholicism, but at a particular point in history. It's just that this particular point in history is so zany, it's so weird, it's so unbelievably random that things are changing under our very eyes. And so it's quite difficult to know how to create a framework to make a perspective. And so I'm going to do it slightly autobiographically, I think, because in order to understand quite how dangerous and difficult the cultural change is, one needs to put it in a kind of context. So, if I may use my life as a context, if you'll forgive me, it's a bit solipsistic, but it's a way of doing it. It was Soren Kierkegaard who said that one of the most difficult things we have to encounter is that we have to live our life forwards, but we only really understand it backwards. So, if you're in the middle of trying to understand your life and you're only a couple of decades in, that's quite okay. It makes more sense as you get nearer the other end. I don't think I could have persuaded myself as a 19 or 21-year-old about the circumstances that we're facing today. In a way, I'm quite pleased to be alive today, because one of the characteristics of what we're going through is that, if you like, the cosmological or the cosmic, the metaphysical powers of evil and good have begun to emerge in a very clear way. I think there are quite a lot of parallels with Berlin in the 1930s, when a whole load of things were going on, that something very, very dangerous was beginning to erupt under the surface. And people who cried out with alarm, saying this is difficult, were rubbished as paranoid. But actually, they were right. And I think we need a few voices to cry out in alarm, and I'm going to be one of them. I think there's a lot to be alarmed about. But then let me try and justify that and explain why. It's true, I've only been a Catholic 4 years, but I think I've been preparing to be a Catholic for a really long time. I was sent by divine accident, I think now, to school built around Canterbury Cathedral. So for the pretentious bourgeois parents, they call it the oldest school in the United Kingdom. But for me, it was a place where the shadow of God or the possibility of God loomed large in the cathedral. And there were a number of reasons to have find an ongoing relationship with the possibility of God. And I found myself particularly drawn, in a sort of form of adolescent fixation, to Thomas à Becket. And I was, there's a place where he was struck down, the cloisters. And at the time, I didn't know about his shrine. I didn't know about the extraordinary miracles. I didn't know about the power of Catholic pilgrimage that Becket represented until Henry VIII stripped it in a political and economic coup. But it was enormously important in England. And Becket was a figure of great holiness. And the interesting thing about Becket, which I understood even as a 13-year-old, was that there was always going to be a conflict between the conscience and the state. So now you can, we can go into whether Becket changed sides and how much of a saint he was, and did he wear his hair shirt for private or public reasons, but it doesn't matter. For us, he stands as the Catholic guarantor of the conscience against a rapacious, untrustworthy state, as an archetype, but anyway, even if it's not a very full reading of history, it works well enough. And so I used to talk to him. I didn't know that Anglicans weren't allowed to pray to the saints, so it seemed to me to be quite a natural thing to do. And I was always, as an adolescent, involved in authority issues anyway, as most good adolescents should be. So he was an excellent patron saint, and I got on very well with him. And now, looking back, I can see why. Because looking back at the moment, there is a very serious crisis of the Catholic conscience. If I was going to give myself a title for the talk, I think I might choose something like that. This is a moment of crisis for the Catholic conscience, because we face a potential change of culture where it looks as though we're about to slip into totalitarianism. Now, I told you I'd be one of those voices crying out with alarm, and you may say, surely that's a bit much. So I want to explain why. My own journey, I have no difficulty believing in God because I had one of those out-of-the-body experiences when I was 19. I drunk myself to death by drinking a liter of vodka. As a university chaplain, I tragically buried people, my students, three or four a year, most of them suicides. And I tell you, I can tell you now that I know you can drink yourself to death with a great deal less than a liter of spirit. The reason I think it happened to me, and I met God, and I'm telling you this not to sort of big myself up, but I have no difficulty believing in God because I've met him, and it's sufficiently important to tell you about it. It's also sufficiently important to tell you that an enormous number of people have. There's something called the Alistair Hardy Religious Research Unit, which was set up by the man who used to hold Dawkins's chair. He was a biologist. He had some strange experiences in the First World War. Went away to Antarctica for 3 years, paid the Oxford Mail for a PO box, and put an advertisement up saying, if you had any strange religious experiences, please put them on a postcard. When he came back, he faced an enormous bill and a problem for storage. Because, in fact, despite the fact that Freud has terrified our society, even in the 1920s, into not taking religious experience seriously, there's a very great deal of religious experience about. So, let me, as a kind of footnote, say that one of the things that Catholics should do with our experience of the supernatural and of the miraculous and of lives of sanctity is we need to say to our secular society that in the name of Freud and under his influence has outlawed religious experience. We need to say that what you may be experiencing is real. We don't know if it's good or evil. We don't even know if it's erupted from your unconscious, but we have ways of finding out. But it happens. And we are the people who can help you interpret it. So don't, what I want to say is don't swallow the secular propaganda that religious, spiritual, numinous experience doesn't happen. There's an enormous amount of it around. One of the interesting things, of course, is to ask why our society opted for the Freudian approach. It wanted, I think, not to have religious experience on the table. And that may partly be because of the shock of the two world wars or the effect of secularism or Darwinism, who knows? But in my case, the reason I think it happened was I drank the vodka. I was having a year abroad in Canada teaching music. I left my body. It's all completely classic, very, very, very ordinary when you read the other accounts of it. I have to say there's a that that there's a cycle there's a school of psychology that suggests that the whole thing is in fact simply an experience of your own nervous system, and that all the black tunnels and the lights are just a way of the conscious or unconscious interpreting the phenomenological process of what's going on. I'm not convinced by that, but it's only fair to say that's what some people think, or that's how they deal with it. As it was, I went to heaven, or I went to judgment. And the reason I think this happened is I just don't believe that my unconscious could have created this act of fiction out of nowhere. I was judged, and I remember thinking, if I'm sent to hell, I will have the satisfaction of knowing there's justice at the heart of the universe, which is a strange thing for a drunken 19-year-old to think. But nonetheless, I don't take any credit for it. It was a thought that I thought came to me. There was silence in heaven in half an hour, for half an hour, which is in the apocalypse. A decision was taken that I would be sent back, and I was sent back. And again, the reason I think it happened is I get very squiffy on 2 pints of Guinness. I keep close to a toilet. My digestion system is never very good. And I don't handle alcohol at all well. So that must be the other DNA set I suffer from, clearly not the Celtic one. But when I came to at 5 in the morning, I was supremely well. I was very well physically. I was very well mentally. In fact, the reason I drunk the bottle of vodka was because I'd beaten up my boss the night before because he had stolen our money. And my other colleague, music teacher, said, "Gav, you're the most eloquent." I think they meant the most violent amongst us. Would you go and get it? So I picked him up by the lapels and banged him against the wall until he offered to pay us. And I was very upset by that. I only tell you that because I had this very strong sense that if I'd been sent back and been forgiven, the only way I can retain this extraordinary sense of forgiveness would be to pass it on. Who must I pass it on to? Oh, that man. So I hung around stalking him for him to come out for breakfast. And he came out the door. His name was Ricardo. And I said, "Ricardo, come here." He took one look at me and didn't want to be beaten up again, so he walked away. No, come here. I want to forgive you." I don't think he heard me properly because he walked faster. So I walked faster and he ran, I ran. Finally, I caught him and I shook him by the lapels. "I've come to forgive you." I thought, this is not the way it ought to work out. Anyway, The important point was that forgiveness lay right at the heart of it again. And I don't see why a seriously drunken 19-year-old should have been so preoccupied with forgiveness, unless there was something, let's use the word objective, to it. I've never had any difficulty believing in God for that, and also because I simply can't manage the question of why should be something rather than nothing. Philosophically, I'm perpetually bamboozled by it. I mean, when I'm walking down the road, when I'm saying my prayers, when I'm in an airplane, I constantly think, how is it we're here? How is it there's something rather than nothing? And it predicates the very strong possibility of God, because what else could it predicate? So these are two reasons why I've never had any difficulty with believing in God, but it's not always been clear to me what God looks like. So I then had an evangelical conversion as a law student. So then God looked like Jesus. That was all right. Instead of becoming a lawyer, I became an Anglican priest, which was a bit of a problem because I've never liked clergy. I like the ones here, of course, but always an exception. And then I began to do some further study. I even spent 2 years with the Jesuits, so anything that I'd say that's wrong, you can attribute to that. I found myself teaching at a university. But before that, in the early 1980s, there were two particular literary influences on me that continue to be pertinent to this day. As I've told this story in the past, I've said they were Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn, and I was sitting in the corner this morning thinking, but is that true? What would I say that Dostoevsky did for me? And then I kind of know, but I think actually I don't think it was. I think it's much more Tolkien. And the reason, I mean, there's just been a book that I'm reading at the moment. It's just been published on Tolkien's Catholicism. No one's done it before. Extraordinary. I mean, clearly people have written essays and paperbacks, but this is the first spiritual, religious, Catholic biography. It's come out in the last month. And like everybody else, I read Lord of the Rings as a teenager. And I think I seriously misunderestimated the influence that the Catholic mind that Tolkien has had as an effect on me, particularly in the struggle between good and evil, which we're going to be talking about more clearly in a moment, if I can keep track of my thoughts. But also Solzhenitsyn. And I was very moved indeed by what had happened to the church in Russia. In fact, I was astonished at the history of the 20th century, which is only halfway through, just beyond halfway through, which is these two extraordinary phenomena of fascism and Marxism, which, as Jordan Peterson constantly tries to remind people, have created the most murderous circumstances, both in terms of intensity and efficiency and numbers, that human beings have ever managed. The idea that we live in a culture that thinks the 20th century has shown some kind of progress, you know, except the iPhone and satellites, but I mean, moral progress, quite the opposite, entirely the opposite. But one of the reasons so having read Solzhenitsyn, I thought, well, I ought to do something for my Christian brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. And so I was given the opportunity to become a smuggler. And I smuggled Bibles into the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia. And I got caught a couple of times and unpleasantly interrogated. I think that Putin interrogated me in Moscow in 82, because it was a major in the KGB. It looks just like him. He was a very tricky customer indeed. And I mean, the experiences of interrogation were really quite horrible and very serious. And one of the things that both being interrogated and also sneaking around the streets of Moscow, Stalingrad, Leningrad, as it was, and Prague has left me was with what it looks like to be a Christian in a totalitarian society. So that's a whole other story. But you can imagine by in 1989, 6 or 7 years later, when the wall came down, I simply couldn't believe it. I literally couldn't believe the wall could come down and the whole thing could collapse. Well, we knew the reasons for it. We knew that they'd been that the whole economy was built on false paper trails. But still, it was quite extraordinary. And then, like a lot of other people, like Fukuyama, particularly, who wrote that book, The End of History, I thought we've reached a liberal plateau, which is a really good and wonderful thing. I can sit back and enjoy myself. And something very strange happened around about the year 2000. It felt like I tasted or I smelt Russia. I mean, Soviet Russia. And I thought, this is weird. How can this be? There must be, you know, maybe some pills would cure this. So I began to sit down and think and pray and read. And that was when I came across the Frankfurt School, which frankly, I mean, no one had talked about in those days. I know it's fairly cool now to know a bit about them, but they were a very specialist niche subject up until 10 years ago. And I came across what looked like the this if not this is let's call it an accidental conspiracy, just to try and keep our sanity as best we can. This accidental conspiracy of postmodernism and the Frankfurt School and what was going to become the new culture wars, which we're calling woke. And I could see, even in 2005 or 6, that the trajectory of this was going to be the eradication of the freedom of speech and conscience. I mean, it's not difficult. You just put the things together, and that's how they string out. But I thought, but it can't happen. I mean, there'll be enough liberal, democratic confidence and conscience for this never to happen. As the case was, I was in the UK's most progressive university. It was both the centre of LGBTQ++, but also everyone would have credited as being probably our most Marxist university, even in those days. So I was surrounded by colleagues and by sort of, it was all in the water. And so indeed that began to happen. In fact, there's a rather delightful and really quite extraordinary aspect to the story, which is that one of the reasons I had tenure, and I had ambitions maybe to get promoted from where I was, and I was very reluctant to give it up. But one of the problems was I changed my mind on the whole LGBT issue. Let's try and keep things in order. Let's talk about Kathleen Stock first, and then go back to that. So we occasionally had meetings in my department with philosophers, and Kathleen Stock was one of the new, very, you know who she is, I'm sure. Do you know who she is? Okay, Kathleen Stock is the one of the most famous and courageous TERFs. She's a professor. She's a lesbian professor of philosophy at Sussex. She was the very swift, neat, dashing kid on the block around about 2010. My natural enemy philosophically, spiritually, culturally, and so she began to epitomize for me the forces that were going to drive me out as I became increasingly Catholic, increasingly conservative, and less increasingly LGBT plus favorable, which I'll come to in a moment. So I resigned my tenure because I knew I'd get sacked, partly because I was the Anglican version of Father James Martin. For about 15 years, I was strongly pro-LGBT for reasons that I can explain to you. I understand the Pope's position. I can see him saying, thinking, and feeling all the things I said, thought, and felt. I can see them in James Martin as well, and I know how they've come to where they've come to, and I also know how incredibly difficult it's going to be for them to move, and why they are disastrously mistaken. Because I was also disastrously mistaken. I had spent some time putting into action. But let's go back to Kathleen. So I resigned my position because I didn't want to be sacked. I'd done some quite good work over 23 years. I'd done some good academic work. I'd done some good pastoral work, some political work. About 5 years running, when the Students' Union went on strike, they asked me to become the arbitrator between them and the management. I had quite a lot of kudos. I didn't want to be sacked, so I left. What I could never, ever have guessed was that dear Kathleen Stock, poster girl of everything the university stood for, 7 years later would be driven out by the students as an unacceptable TERF because she wanted to insist that women ought to have spaces that were safe from the male sexual appetite. But that's what's happened. And I wrote to her. So I'm so sorry. I thought that was going to be me. Actually, it was her. Let's go back one step. The reason I was so friendly towards the LGBT cause was partly because I'm a musician. I'm a sort of bad part-time musician, but I've always had gay friends. I know this sounds like, even some of my friends are Jewish, but nonetheless, I had a number of gay friends. And one of the things I felt very strongly about was that God's love ought to be able to touch people who had a great sense of their own dislocation and not belonging. And to have your physical biology and your romantic desire set against each other is a very awkward place to be. And then, it had been put about for some time. The church had been homophobic, and I bought in rather foolishly and carelessly to the rewriting of history that had started there even then. And if you take anything away from today, then listen to David Quinn saying, do not buy into the false narratives that they are shoving at us all the time. I mean, day by day, they're changing. It's extremely important that you find different sources of information in order to be able to factually account for them. And I wanted to bring the love of Christ to people whose lives were messy, complicated, wounded, broken, disordered. And the only way to do that was to begin to change church teaching. So if you're a Protestant, that's easy, because there are so many ways you can interpret Bible verses and so many kind of false contexts you can place them in. It's just, you know, it's a matter of a few imaginative seconds to be able to take something of St. Paul and to explain how he meant exactly the opposite, or should have meant exactly the opposite. And becoming a Catholic involved changing my mind, both about the gay issue, but also about the abortion issue. Let me just tell you about the abortion issue quickly, because I want to keep the line of thought, and the abortion one sticks, it's fairly neatly done. I had never had any thoughts about abortion. I simply assumed that feminism knew what it was doing. It seemed to me to be a matter of human rights. I wasn't hugely sympathetic to it psychologically, because I'm a sort of man's man, but I could see that if you wanted to be a woman's woman, why shouldn't you talk and think like that? And if any of you ever saw the Peterson interview with that rather rapacious brunette lady who refused to accept some of the facts about white goods and contraception. But I thought the one reason that was a very important interview was because she did a very, very good job of articulating the feminist position, which Peterson does an even better job of shooting down. But nonetheless, it was important to have it articulated so you can see what's wrong with it. And so I bought into it. And it was on a radio program. I had this radio program on the BBC. It was quite successful. And one of the things I would do when people were going on, because it was a phone-in, is I would Google. And, you know, because it's always good to have better facts than people you're talking to. So this lady was going on about abortion, and I was basically my body, my choice. Why not? Surely. And as she was rabbiting on, I just checked the numbers. So this would be about 2007, 2008. So I told you that 30% of my genes are Celtic. 30% of them are Jewish. So when I typed in numbers of aborted children, and it came up with the figure 6 million, I took an intake of breath. It's live on air. I wasn't thinking. It was a reflex. I said, but that's a Holocaust. Well, a number of things happened. I was carpeted the next morning by the head of the station saying, you must never, ever, ever use that language again. And I said, but it's the Holocaust figure. So there's nothing to argue about. All we've got to argue about is whether they were people or not. If they're not people, then it's just a numerical accident. If they are people, it's actually enormously serious. But the BBC wasn't interested in that. They just, rather, as we've already said before, it was not to be discussed, as Melanie said earlier on, not immigration, not abortion. It's off the menu. So I went and did some thinking. I had no idea they'd got rid of 6 million viable fetuses in the time since they passed the bill, which I remember when it happened. And then I began to do some more thinking. Let's say for a moment that it's helpful to imagine us as sort of not compartmentalized. We are compartmentalized, but also composite, body, mind, and spirit. We know about our bodies, we know about our minds. As Catholics, we're strongly committed to the notion of our soul and spirit. One of the things we don't do in our culture is we often ask the body questions. We often ask the how and the what questions of science. And we've got quite good at the mind questions, and psychology has been immensely useful to us, but also very misleading. So we can do the body and the mind, but all the confidence has been kicked out of us on the spirit or the pneumatic or the metaphysical areas. We're very anxious about that. And the church has been profoundly enfeebled. And yet we have a Catholic church has a very, very well-resourced history of spiritual discernment, which as no other body has, which ought to be used. We can use it and if you like, falsify anything that's wrong, but it should be, at least be used. And it began to occur to me that the abortion issue could not just be understood in terms of numbers or even the psychology and politics, but there was something profoundly spiritual to this. we were sacrificing our babies to an alien god. What is this alien god? Well, autonomy, progress, convenience, a fake way of buying absolution. The list, you know, the list grows and grows, but we were killing our babies for a different value system. And, you know, that's what a god is. A god is either a value system or more than that. And then it occurred to me that if that was what we were doing, then in terms of the struggle between good and evil, that had enormously powerful implications. If there is an objective evil, if evil can be fed or strengthened by that kind of behavior, and if you look at the occult literature or literature of religion, there are reasons for suggesting it might be, then a society that begins to sacrifice its own children, living children, to this alternative god, maybe really shifting the weight in the scales between good and evil. And frankly, I think that's exactly what's happened. I think one of the reasons why the culture is in such very, very rapid meltdown is because at a metaphysical level, we have behaved appallingly. If you were ever disturbed or disgusted by what the Incas do, we make them look, with their sacrifices, we make the Incas look amateurish. Just look at the numbers of the human beings that we've killed. Why human beings? Well, because you either have to say this fetus becomes a human being at this indeterminate stage, somewhere between when the cells divide and when it's born, or you say it's the human being from the moment. And there is no answer to the first thing. There is no point at which anyone can agree. So you might as well say either it's not a human being, let's kill them as they come out, which is exactly where they've come to now, or you say it's a human being from the moment of conception. And if it really is, then what we've done this century stands as one of the greatest crimes that could possibly happen. And all this occurred to me really quite quickly during this phone-in, once I Googled the numbers and then began to think about it. But people don't think about it because they're not allowed to talk about it. And we're back to Peterson again. The only way you know what you think is by talking about it. And the enemy has stopped us talking. They've accused us of hate crime and thought crime, and they're now exercising censorship. And this is what woke is doing to us. So, again, I hadn't taken on board the full implications of the hate crime legislation that you passed in Ireland. I'm astonished it could have happened, but it'll happen in England quite soon, of course. And it's designed to make there a presumption of guilt, and B, to make us guilty if we think Catholic and Christian things. So that's why we're in a very, very serious fight indeed. And the question is, where two things have to happen. One is we have to wake up to how serious it is, and then we have to decide what we're going to do about it. My views on the LGBT thing were changed by two things. One was that by accident, the rather murky underground of homosexual culture was shared with me in a couple of pastoral encounters. I won't trouble you with it now. It's not worth recording. It's not worth talking about. But it struck me that one of the things we've been told, one of the lies we've been told, is that the behind the disordered conflict of biology and appetite lies an equally meritorious moral culture amongst homosexuals as it does amongst heterosexuals. Now, the reason that's not true is, first of all, there is no meritorious culture amongst heterosexuals. Our sexual lives stink. And what we've been doing with unmonitored sexuality as heterosexuals is pretty terrible. It's just look at the pornography industry and everything it's done to you know, and that's a whole other area we can go in, but we won't go into it now. Well, if you think the heterosexuals are bad, I have to tell you that the homosexual culture is worse. And it was only when I discovered how worse it was that I began to reconsider what I'd been told by the media, by all the supporters. And so I then began to ask myself, I better rethink this. The other thing that happened, and this is slightly difficult to talk about because it's special pleading and it's a little bit embarrassing, but I really credit my conversion to Catholicism to the devil. Now, I'm very hesitant to talk about the devil. And one should, you know, C.S. Lewis was quite right. There are two mistakes he'd like to lure us into. One is disbelieving in him and not talking about him, and the other is by talking about him too much. So I hope to talk about him a little. But the reason I can do that is because the Catholic Church, and one of the things I hope you'll take away, is that the Catholic Church is the only institution in culture, in history, in the world at the moment that has the capacity to deal with metaphysical evil. No other organization, no other thought process, no other philosophy, with the exception of the Eastern Patriarchates. So for the moment, can we assume pre-1054? No other church. I mean, I heard it said the other day when this new exorcist film was put out and people were discussing the merits of different kinds of ecumenical ministry. No one, when they discover that their daughter has been possessed, goes running up and down the street asking for the Baptist pastor. They always look for the Catholic priest because they know. And so what happened at this time was that I not only had I become pro-LGBT plus, but I'd essentially become a Jungian. This is a whole other lecture, and I must keep it very brief. I was delighted to discover Jung, and I rather fell in love with him. But I fell in love with him. It's a bit like the reason you don't have an affair is that the mistress will always be an antidote to the poison of the marriage, but will become the poison if you ever marry the mistress instead. So this is not often spoken about, but there's a great danger in choosing an antidote and imagining you can live with the antidote. The antidote only really often has a purpose in your life in relation to the thing that you think you're needing to deal with. Well, in my case, what I needed to deal with was Freud. And what Freud had done was to set a climate up there where religion was dangerous. You couldn't talk about it. It was a sign of mental instability. And as an Anglican bracket pseudo priest, close brackets, and an academic, I wanted to undermine Freud, and Jung provided me with a means of doing it. Jung is an extraordinarily complex figure, and has essentially set the intellectual, the psychological, and the cultural tone for most of what lies behind woke. It's all about the integration of opposites and some form of bringing in from the edges and self-realization, but it's a form of self-worship. And when Jung does all those kind of the woke tricks, he uses one word to lure you, but he means another word by it. So God for Jung always means the self or the ego. So and it's about self-realization. But Jung was enormously helpful because at an archetypal level, he sent a different message out saying, if you don't deal with your spirituality, you can't achieve any form of self-realization. So instead of spirituality being a neurosis, which is how everyone understood it up until about 1990, when this great change of climate took place. Again, I watched it happen. I was fighting Freud in the academy and on behalf of Jung, and I just saw the climate change under my eyes. It was an extraordinary moment. Again, the speed of change was quite extraordinary. Suddenly Jung became a hero. But the problem with Jung is he doesn't have any, he's of no help at all with theodicy. Theodicy, the basic problem is if there is a good God, how do we explain evil? And you do one of two things. You either say, well, there is no good God, or there is no evil. And our culture has decided to be ambiguous about God, but also to say there is no evil. And so we have the whole sort of Rousseauish position of the left. Human beings are born blank. They just require education. Every time you hear someone say, well, you know, we've learned our lessons and we'll put in education, you know, one wants to weep and say, but reality is not like that. On the other hand, it's very difficult to talk about the devil. And the only reason I dare to do it is because he for reasons I still don't understand, he attacked me two or three times. I don't think there's time to tell you about it, and it's probably as well not to. But what it did was to make me change my metaphysical, theological, and philosophical landscape. The moment you move from a kind of flat Rousseauish, we can get better with education and training, to we're in a Tolkien-esque, New Testament-esque fight to the death with evil, everything changes. But that's what Catholicism is built on. Catholicism has the greatest experience of and ease with the supernatural and the miraculous and the metaphysical. And then the great tragedy of Catholicism is that when people go liberal, they move off into the whole liberal, Protestant, Rousseauish, flat horizon metaphysic. But have they seen what happens to the church when you do that? Liberal Protestantism has failed utterly. I mean, it gave birth to Dawkins, of course, because Protestantism is the mother of atheism and relativism. Have you also noticed, by the way, that having sold us relativism for 50 years, they've now withdrawn it and say, no, we don't really mean that. We do believe in absolutes after all, but there are absolutes, not yours. And your parents' generation, my generation, have been completely suckered in to the whole relativism. And they're changing the narrative now, even as we speak. All things are equal. You know, it's the whole Orwellian things. All things are equal, but some are more equal than others. Everything is relative. There are no absolutes. Everything is welcome except Christianity, because it's an absolute, and we're going to impose a different absolute on it instead. How many more minutes, David? Fine. So one of the things my sense of the struggle with evil took me to Mary and the Mass. It took me to the Mass because I had a very strange experience where I was in a place called Le Puy-en-Velay, where there's a very special Mount St. Michael who I was becoming interested in. And if you need any theological imprimatur for what I'm about to say, it's just Leo the 13th and 1884 and the prayer to St. Michael and the whole sense that he was given that the next 100 years or so were going to be a most profound conflict between good and evil, and the church was going to take a very, very severe hammering. So the Catholic Church knew about this. It knows about it. And I became interested in two things, Our Lady's apparitions and the Mass. So I had this very strange experience when a vortex of what appeared to me to be bats, malicious bats who came with a particular message, as evil always does. It has two motifs by which you can always recognize it. First of all, it says there is no hope, and secondly, it's your fault. So if you ever find little words whispering in your own head, which you think belong to you, there is no hope, and it's your own fault, do not take this as a sign of your psychological or existential weakness. It's almost certainly the symptom of your finding yourself standing in a struggle between good and evil. And as faithful traditional Catholics, you always will do. So never, never take seriously this mantra, there is no hope and it's all your fault. And then during this particular Mass, where I thought I'd had a stroke, in fact, I hadn't, there was a little theological camera in the back of my head in the control room. I said, well, this does make me want to run out screaming. If I could run, but I can't, my body doesn't work anymore. But I wonder when it'll stop and what'll make it stop. You know, what's the theological game plan here? And so, you know, Mass was celebrated and it wasn't the epiclesis, it wasn't the raising of the sacrament, the elevation, it wasn't the putting of the host into my hand, though one should never receive in the hand. It was when our Lord touched my tongue, it was that the whole thing got switched off. I thought, well, okay, so that's interesting. So the host on the tongue matters a great deal. It's a, you know, at least it matters to the other side. And so that began to make me look more closely, and I discovered the Eucharistic miracles. And I'm sure you don't need me to tell them about them. But once I discovered Buenos Aires in 94, again, I can't understand why the Catholic Church is being so quiet. The enemy always throw Galileo at us. And by the way, you do know Galileo was not tortured and he wasn't locked up for being heliocentric. He was rude to the Pope in a tweet. He sent out a bad tweet, and the Pope, who was a very grumpy, bad tempered Pope, careless of his own reputation in those days, locked him up as a punishment. The relationship between Galileo and science and heliocentrism is much more complex than the false narrative that the woke present us with. The church, science could only ever have emerged from a Christian Catholic culture. And Christian Catholic culture has been at the forefront of promoting it. And so the fact that we have these Eucharistic miracles and that we, you know, we have laboratories that have slightly improperly, to my mind, tested the host and come up with the results that they have. These are living white blood cells from a particular ventricle. I mean, it's almost too much. I would rather that it wasn't quite so cannibalistic. I would say, Lord, could you not be a little more, a little more symbolic, please? But there isn't any other way of dealing with this. And this, for me, this was huge, because the whole of my life as an Anglican, I've been taking part in an argument, a Reformation argument between Zwingli Luther and the Council of Trent. Now, where on this line is what happens at Mass? And the answer is, it's where the Catholics always said it was. And now science said, but this is huge. Why is the Catholic Church not saying to the Protestants, guys, you've got it wrong. Come home. Don't do all this vacant bread stuff. It won't do you any good. This is, and particularly won't do you any good if you're engaged in the struggle between good and evil. And then I became very interested in Our Lady. And the reason I came into Our Lady was because I went 3 nights without sleep whilst I had some kind of demonic experience of a terrible assault. After the first night, I phoned up a friend of mine who happened to be the Catholic exorcist for the Diocese of Leeds. And I said, John, look, these things are happening. Am I having a nervous breakdown or is it what it looks like it is? And he said, I'm sorry, it's what, I don't know what's gone wrong, but it's, you know, yes, it's the real McCoy. What do I do? He said, well, you pray the rosary. And I said, well, I know all about the rosary and I know about Our Lady theologically. And I just saw those things I don't do. Hey, up, lad, he said, because he was from Yorkshire, you've got to choose between hell and Our Lady. What's it going to be? So I began praying the rosary, and then the second night, this terrible, terrible thing diminished. It started at 5 to 1 and it ended at 5 to 5, all 3 nights. And my wife thought I was having a nervous breakdown, and she wasn't remotely sympathetic. I told you this would happen if you work this hard. You shouldn't work this hard. It's your own fault. You could, anyways, never mind about that. But the third night, what happened was, I think you'll like this bit. It began to diminish, and I began to fall asleep, I guess, about 3 o'clock, which first time I'd been asleep for 3 nights. And after half an hour, she dug me in the back and woke me up and said, in these highly pressured domestic circumstances, I'm surprised you'd want to go looking for a matrimonial fight. I said, woman, leave me alone. I'm losing my mind. I've just fallen asleep. Be a friend, not an enemy. What's the matter with you? And now my wife has a very highly developed sense of smell. So in the spring, we have to close the bedroom windows because the smell of the flowers keeps her awake, and it's very unpleasant for her, understandably. It's my job to close the window. I have a number of jobs, not many, she would tell you. And the ones that I do, I don't do terribly effectively, as you can see on this occasion, one of them. She said, why didn't you close the windows? But as it happened, having been under the cosh, I had closed the windows. So I said, the windows are closed. She said, you know, you're only making matters worse if you lie. You should tell the truth. So, you know, she got out of bed, and for those of you who are married, you know, there's a kind of footstep. I heard the footstep go to that, and then I heard the footstep change as it came back, and I thought, this is my moment. And I said, so is it open or closed? Closed, she said, in silence. Then she said, well, you need to explain to me why the room is so full of the smell of roses that I can't sleep. And I said, well, you know, I know academically it's a sign that Our Lady's present. Well, she said, it's about time she turned up. You've been clacking those beads for 3 nights. So she had turned up, and I needed to find out a bit more about her, because if you've been on the edge 3 nights of demonic attack, it just, I have to tell you, puts you as close to being sectioned as you'd ever want to be. And it was no longer theoretical. And then I started with Garabandal, because I was 9, Garabandal. And I thought, well, maybe they move, you know, I'd seen the stuff out of Fatima. And the difficulty of being a Protestant is it's not, you know, it's not very convincing. It looks like it's, you know, I had books on Eucharistic miracles, but you read them as a sort of materialist skeptic, and you wonder if they're just not just too hagiographical, and where's the corroboration? It's difficult if you come from the outside. But so there was Garabandal on, and I watched it happen, and I was just astonished. And I was watching it in my academic office, and a colleague from the psychology department came in. And she said, what are you watching? I said, well, it purports to be children having an experience of the Virgin Mary in 1963 in northern Spain. And she looked at it and said, well, what are the children saying? And I said, well, Our Lady's saying that we must pray more and repent and pray the rosary and tell the hierarchy to get their act in order. It's always the same. and she said, well, whatever those children tell you is happening, you can rely on. And I said, well, why do you say that? And she said, well, because actually my area of speciality is to do with prepubescent children, and they cannot fake ecstasy. And quite clearly what you're showing me is children in a state of ecstasy. And I happen to know as a psychologist that you can't fake that. So we have to assume it's genuine. Well, we can't think of any other, you know, they hadn't been taking drugs. They hadn't been hypnotized. So it doesn't leave many other options. So it says, so a psychologist, I'd say that's genuine. I would say you could afford to believe in that. So I began to read up more, and then of course, by accident, I found myself in Zaytun. Do you know about Zaytun? Oh, it's. See, nobody knows about Zaytun. Our Lady appeared in downtown Egypt in 1968, And she had three bylines in three of the major newspapers, like one in the London Times, one in the New York Times. But she appeared for 6 months. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were converted. All kinds of spectacular healings took place. This is 1968, not 1368. It's all accessible. And again, one of the things the church has not done, okay, this is the East rather than the West, but the church, we have this stuff taking place, and we're too shy. We'd like to, you know, I want you to become more Catholic. You need to toughen up as Catholics. You need to be Catholics. It's all in your court. You have all the stuff. Nobody else has it, for goodness sake. If we don't use it, it will go to waste. But we can't let it go to waste, because the times they're too dangerous. I think I want to leave you with a picture. I see a sort of amphitheater at the moment across the world. You know, the world has become compressed. And it's as if in the amphitheater, the figures of Muhammad and Marx and Jesus have been put to a fight to the death. Actually, Marx has got Darwin, the little Darwin on a bit of his arm. It's Marx and Darwin together, really. But what's happened is that the Marx and Muhammad have struck a compact. And Muhammad's sitting in the corner and he's sitting it out. And Marx is down. So let's move it from the historical figures to the representatives of. So the representatives of Marx and Darwin are really hammering the representatives of Christ, something very, very badly. And they know they're going to win. And Muhammad's sitting in the corner. But the representatives of Marx aren't worried about Muhammad. They reckon if we can do this to the Christians, we can absolutely hammer the Muslims. Muslims are more primitive even than the Christians. They don't understand Islam. They don't understand that Islam is not a cousin Abrahamic religion. It's a highly complex composite between a religion and a political system, and it doesn't play by the same rules at all. And Marx and Darwin only understand the Judeo-Christian rules. They've entirely misunderstood. Just in brackets, don't buy the propaganda. There's a book called The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise. For about 15 years, the BBC were perpetually pushing the Convivencia in Spain under Muslim hegemony as a wonderful period of cooperation. Hundreds of thousands of dollars has gone from Saudi Arabia to buy academics to write lying histories about what happened in Spain. The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise is a book that tells you the truth by somebody who hasn't been bought, and it's entirely counterfactual. And you need to read it, because again, they're not telling us the truth about what actually happened. And what happened was extraordinary. My reading of where we are is that in Europe and in America, I don't know about America, but I think for Europe, sure, we'll be Islamic within a generation. And I say this to you because my Islamic colleagues told me this. I used to run interfaith seminars. I was very closely involved with Islamic Christian conversations in the 1990s. I have some good Islamic friends, and they know the dates. And if you have any of you read the Belgian novelist? Oh, I'm getting old. I forget all the names now. Submission by Hulebeck. Okay, have you read Submission by Hulebeck? Okay, put it on your reading list. It's extremely important. It's only a novel, and it didn't happen at the election in France he thought it was going to, but some version of it will happen as Islamic political power. You only need 12% of the electorate to take control. That's what happened in Nazi Germany, or a few tanks, which will happen in Moscow. But very soon there'll be far more Muslims voting for a single Muslim party will hold the balance of power. The good news is that there's been this extraordinary resurgence of Christianity in Russia. In 1989, the number of people who self-identify as Russian Orthodox was fewer than those who suffer from gender dysphoria as a proportion in our country, less than 0.01. Now it's something like 60 or 70%. I make no comment on what the value of it is. But again, if you told me that from 1919 to 2023, the Russian population self-identifying as Christian would go from those numbers, I would say it's just not possible. I'm told that by 2060, there'll be more Christians than anybody else in China, if the present demographics keep up. I've checked out the first one. I haven't checked out the second one. I only heard it yesterday, but I thought it's too good not to put it in front of you. So what we've got is, we've got this extraordinary emergence of Christianity in both Russia and China. Africa's hanging in the balance, though each year it looks like the Muslims are beginning to gain strength there, and Europe's gone. And America, who knows, civil war, full woke in the blue states, no idea. But it's not it won't see a resurgence of Christianity. So what are we going to do? Well, we have to be as Catholic as we possibly can. And whilst we're allowed in the public space, and it's not going to last much more than 5 years, is it? I mean, if they've just told the police they can come and knock on your door and take away all your electronic instruments, how much longer is it going to be before we're allowed to hold our views in the public space? I think it's back to the catacombs for us. And in these 5 years, we first of all have to get our ideas straight. We have to say our prayers. We have to clean up our spirituality. We have to pray for a new pope. And we we have to make sure that our networks of engagement are in place before they drive us out of the public square. But we can do all that if we know what's happening. And so I'm very, very glad to have become a Catholic. I'm sorry it took me so long, but I'm here now. So a little bit, sure. So, well, the synod is probably the most difficult thing we have to talk about, and I'm probably amongst the least qualified, though I've been trying to think and pray my way through it. A lot of people say to me, don't you wish you'd become a Catholic at a different time? And I suppose, you know, the simple answer is, it wouldn't have been nice to become a Catholic under JP2. But the real answer is, there's a fight on. And I know about the fight. I could have told you the ways in which I'd seen the ordination of women and the gay debate playing out in Anglicanism. And again, it's simply extraordinary to me that those who are promoting it within Catholicism don't acknowledge the utter and complete disaster that it's been in liberal Protestantism. I think never attribute to malice what can be attributed to stupidity. That's really important. Write it down, make it your watchword. It will keep you sane, save you from making mistakes. But this last dubia has made me feel that the whole thing is being strategized. I'm deeply sympathetic to Pope Francis. I understand why. I mean, he doesn't think he's doing bad. He thinks he's doing good. And again, for your own, the way to understand yourself, you must know what your first principles are. Whatever your first presuppositions are, presuppositions really, and they're usually semi-conscious. All of us have to be very clear what our kind of our priorities of epistemology are. And so for the liberal Catholic, it's compassion and it's kindness. And this is partly to do with very bad Bible reading. It's partly to do with the peace and justice movement. So I'm going off on a bit, but this is quite important, I think. So because you've been bamboozled by peace and justice for so long, there's the assumption that perhaps the Old Testament is all about that. It really isn't. The Old Testament is about purity. So in fact, the two halves of the Bible are purity and then the incarnation. Incarnation compassion. Essentially, go for Good Samaritan if you want anything, because Jesus is a Good Samaritan. But the Old Testament is about holiness. It's about separation. And for all the mockery about hygiene and cooking and morals, it's always about purity, training in purity and the training in holiness. And the idea, if you hijack that and turn it into peace and justice, then you immediately slip onto the ground of the Rousseau-utopianism. As David said, was it David or Gerard? One of them said, get them to tell you what their end goal is, because there isn't one. The whole thing spiritually is a demonic hit job. All secular utopianism is a demonic hit job. It just wants to pull down. There is nothing that it's going for. There is no end game. There is no utopia. There is no system of peace, justice, and equality. It doesn't exist, and every time it exists, they pull it down anyway. That's how we know, metaphysically, it's a demonic hit job, and we need to expose it as such. But if you do the peace and justice thing that Catholics have been doing, then you simply move your weight over to their platform, but it isn't. If you say it's holiness and purity, then you move it back to where actually it really does belong, and everything else flows from that. If you talk about we're going to do some kind of reparative theological work about sexuality in terms of justice, well, you end up with the LGBT plus Jimmy Martin stuff. If you say we're going to interpret our sexuality in terms of holiness, then you do it with chastity and restraint, and you get a different result. So you have to do your biblical theology properly. I do understand where they're coming from, and I sympathize. It took a lot to get me to change my mind. I don't expect the Pope has long enough to change his mind, though you must pray for him that he does. And James Martin is clear self-interest. And the problem with all the others who come on board is that it's nice to be nice. Who doesn't want to be nice? And nobody tells the truth about their sex lives anyway. So in this grand complicity of silence and being nice, we end up with where we are. But both scripture and tradition and the magisterium tell us something different. We're Catholics, we should be able to run with that. Yes. Someone here was, yeah. Sorry, say again. I'm English. Yes. Yes. Yep. That's judgment. It's just judgment. I'm nearly 70, and tomorrow, if I ride a motorbike, so I have a very vivid sense of the imminence of judgment. Also, it happened to me once before, so I'm on borrowed time. It's just judgment, and that judgment, you know, at that point, we will meet our merciful Lord. And I'm so glad to believe in purgatory for all kinds of reasons. I could give you a lecture on why purgatory is wonderful. For the moment, it's just judgment. We're back again to the horror of abortion. The horror of abortion is that these live people didn't get their lives. So we've been given our lives. What are our lives for? They are this incredible gift where we're given free will. The price we pay for it is to find ourselves caught up between good and evil. Don't you like it? Would you kill yourself? In the same moment, nobody will kill themselves. We all like it. We complain about it. It hurts. It's confusing. It's extremely difficult. But there is nothing in the human psyche that says, when you're mentally well, I won't be here. I won't accept the gift of life. We all accept the gift of life in these terms. We complain. We're entitled to complain. There's a wonderful conversation between Mother Julian and our Lord in one of her showings. She says to him, look, do you really know what you're doing? This theodicy thing is extremely hard to explain. And then he talks about this act of inversion on the last day. Well, the worse things were, the better it will be. It's St. Paul. Shall we sin that grace may abound? No, it's not like that. But out of sin, grace does abound. So for us, it's justice, and it's going to be the extraordinary moment when we'd see why the whole thing was worthwhile. We see why it was worth, this sounds blasphemous and horrible, and please forgive me for it. We see why the price of the Holocaust was worth it. We see why the price of the aborted children was worth it. It's our free will we've been given. And God's got, he intends to make children. He wants this kind of deified company. He's put, can I just tell you one more experience with this? Because this is, again, I left it out. But I was in Teze. I had a terrible moment in my life. I was complaining, fit to bust to him, midnight in the chapel. It's a lovely the Francis cross. And I had a picture of our Lord in my head. And I was saying, you've pushed me too far. I can't do this anymore. I'm about to give way. I need your help. And you know, visions don't come very often. What are they? You know, these things, whatever they are. These moments of high impact, we'll call them. So a moment of high impact came, and he said, yeah, okay, I understand. I'm sorry, it's really, really, really tough for you. But actually, because he was on the cross in this moment of high impact, it's not so good up here. Would you be willing to share this with me for a bit? I was outraged. I said, this is about me. I'm right on the edge here. And you want to talk about you? And then I thought about it and said, well, you can't say no to Jesus. So I said, okay, Lord, all right. And then in this high impact moment, he took me on the cross and I began to experience crucifixion. Now, have any of you been under a general anesthetic? They tell you to count to 10. And one of the things I do when I'm in serious pain, also, I count to try and manage the thing. I found myself counting to 10 as this appalling pain, physical, spirit. I didn't get to 7. I just said, I can't take this. Please let me down. And without any telling off or anything else, he just put me back to where I was. And since then, it isn't just about us. This is the key to theodicy is the dying on the cross. He doesn't ask us to do anything that he hasn't gone through himself, isn't willing to do himself. It's a joint cooperative venture between us and him. But that's one of the reasons why we have to keep faith with him. We have to tell the truth about him. We have to put him first. So what is it? Well, he is our beloved. He adores us. He loves us. He's given us this amazing life. We're some of the most pampered people that ever have been. We have anesthetics and iPhones. I know the world hates us, but he told us it would. It's about judgment and then coming home. It's about the book of Revelation. It's about, it's about singing love songs to him outside the confines of time and space. It's very good. But it's nothing to do with what goes on down here. Yes, go on. Probably Padre Pio. I took the name Athanasius because I knew I was in for a fight. I've always loved St. Augustine, but he's a bit wordy sometimes. I'm just gobsmacked by Padre Pio. And again, one of the reasons is he helps me deal with the hagiography stuff. 1968, for goodness sake, not 1588. It's all, there is a spiritual life. And you see it being acted out in the lives of the saints. And one of the most accessible is Padre Pio. Why not be informed? Why not go along for the ride? Why not ask for his prayers? Why not be close to Padre Pio? There are ones I'm not so good at. I wish I liked Thérèse of Lisieux better. I feel I should do. Quite fond of Teresa of Avila. I talk to St. Thomas More quite a lot, Beckett. But for my heart, Padre Pio. Yeah. Yes. No, they're in a 1.8 minus situation. Yeah, for sure. Yes, but that's partly why I think that I think it's one of the factors. I think the Christians may have more children, and that the other Chinese won't. And I think, as I heard, this is a podcast I overheard on the motorbike. So I didn't take notes, but I went, wait a moment, I need to. Actually, I can tell you where I heard it. The Australian vice president, not John Robinson, what's his name? John, the Australian evangelical vice president, John somebody. There's a guy called Glenn Scrivener, Anglican evangelical, quite clever, cleverer than most. Scrivener was talking to John Thingy. Yes, Anderson, thank you so much. John Anderson does a podcast. He's a rather nice, not highly tempered, but interesting ex-vice president of Australia. He has some very good people on. 2 weeks ago, he did Glenn Scrivener. Glenn Scrivener did a very, very good job of articulating some of the basic theological premises of Christianity. I mean, some people have got the gift of the gab for doing it in words we can understand. He does it very well. And it was he who was saying it. It's the first time I'd heard it, so I haven't checked up on it. But it wouldn't surprise me at all that in the same way that, because I think it's got something to do with the spiritual warfare, the whole Daniel and Ezekiel, national angels, there's a kind of, in the stratosphere, there's another climate going on. And it doesn't surprise me at all that both in Russia and in China, our Lord should find hearts prepared by suffering and false utopianism to make himself known. Whereas we who've been given everything and have betrayed him as a culture, we'll get on the pan because we have free will. Over to you.